Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by the Lansing State Journal, offering up-to-date news and information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on your phone, tablet, and online at lsj.com.
It's the Friday edition of Current State. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. You're listening to 90.5 WKAR. We cover a lot of important education topics here today. Coming up, a high-ranking MSU educator, Dr. Donald Heller, who is our who has been at the top of the College of Education here at Michigan State University, is taking issue with the Michigan 2020 plan. This is Senator Gretchen Whitmer's plan to finance some college education for all Michigan high school graduates, and Dr. Heller has come out against the plan, and he explains his problems with it coming up. Lansing's Financial Empowerment Center is one of only five in the nation. It opened yesterday. We'll talk with the organizers behind that as well. But front and center this morning, the Lansing School District has a new contract agreement with its 915-member teachers union. The Lansing Board of Education approved the new pact by an 8-1 vote last night, and here to discuss the new 5-year deal is the president of the Lansing Board of Education, Guillermo Lopez. Welcome back to Current State, Guillermo. Good to see you.
Good morning, Mark.
The administration had an $11 million projected deficit that it was looking at, correct?
Correct.
For the next financial, for the next fiscal year?
Correct.
Is that right? And I'm seeing the district got a pay freeze and some other things. But let's clarify the situation first regarding elementary school art, music, and physical education. There were some changes made in how that is done. Explain what, please.
Well, the changes will occur in the next school year. But for the contract itself, we there's an elimination of 87 full-time equivalency positions.
87 full-time equivalency positions.
Okay. Yes. And that's basically due to release time. In the district, for some years, we had teachers who come in 1 hour or whatever the class hour is for a teacher to do the arts, phys ed, and music, while the teachers go and do their planning time. And the reason we did that is because if we didn't have a certified teacher in class, we would not get the credits for the state aid.
Okay.
All right. So what we're simply doing is the planning time is going to go away the way it is now. Next year is going to be a different way of doing things in an innovative way. We're going to sit down, or the administration is going to sit down with the group, the administrative group, to come up with a plan. And with the teachers to decide what is the process that we're going to do this. It's not going to go away. Okay, that's going to happen.
You know, physical ed, phys ed, and arts
and music are not going away.
In the elementary schools are not going away.
They're not going away.
Okay.
What is going away is the way we've been doing things for several years. We're going to do it in a different way. We're going to have to be innovative about it, and we're going to have to give the teachers that are going to be in the classroom some help. So we will probably have about 8 to 10 consultants that will go around the district assisting our classroom teachers in their planning of music, phys ed, and arts.
Okay, but I want to be absolutely clear on what's happened here. You've taken away a planning hour from the teachers that during which, well, they used to plan, obviously,
right?
But now they will be covering art and phys ed, which used to be
music,
covered
right.
by art, phys
by
ed, and music
person.
That
right.
used to be covered by somebody else who came in just to teach those topics.
Exactly.
Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay, but it's not really clear how this is going to work out. You're saying something about consultants then?
Well, I mean, and you know, this is something that now that we have the contract, our administration and her team can get down to the business of developing the plan.
Exactly how that will play
out. Exactly how that will work.
Okay.
Now, there are some ideas, and there are ideas right now, and one of them is the consultant kind of theory that they'll come and help or teach. Pretty much like professional development, in my view. It's not exactly the same, but somewhat. That's one way. But that's not the way it's going to happen necessarily, okay?
Okay.
What I'm telling you at this point is that we have the contract. Now we know what we have. We know that we saved 87 positions, okay, that are going away. Not saved, but they're going away. Full-time equivalency positions, which brings us a savings of nearly $7 million.
Okay.
Okay?
But 87 full-time equivalencies, that still sounds, in a 915-member district, that's still a pretty significant hit, is it
well,
not?
Well, the state of the economy has caused governments and school boards to think differently.
Okay.
And that is what we're trying to do, while at the same time preserving those key elements of the teaching for kids.
Okay.
They're not going to go away in any way, shape, or form. They're going to be taught differently. That's right.
Okay.
And how different it's going to be, it's in the development stage now.
Remains to be seen.
Right.
And you closed $7 million of the $11 million gap with just that one in just
exactly.
that move. Okay.
Exactly.
You got a pay freeze for 5 years as well. That's
for 2 years.
A pay freeze for two years. The contract was for five, but the pay freeze is only for two?
2 years, and then it's a reopener
Then you reopen.
Then reopen, yeah.
Okay. A bill is making its way through the legislature that would cut state funding to school districts if new long-term contracts don't cut 10% of the total budget. If this bill becomes law, would Lansing be vulnerable to a cut in state aid then?
Well, we have other groups that we're working with within our system, other bargaining units. So do they mean with one union or with our union personnel, period? Okay? Because we have other bargaining units too, so we're not done.
And from the union's point of view, it got a five-year contract that essentially sidesteps right to work?
I don't know if it sidesteps. I think that any teacher has the right not to be a union member.
Okay.
That doesn't keep them from not being a union member if they don't want to.
You're quoted in Kathleen Levy's Lansing State Journal article this morning as still having real concerns about the future. Do you think the district is looking at more deficits in the future then?
Well, the way that the schools are funded and the way the money is being diverted from the education fund to other projects that are out there, like the EAA, the Education Achievement Agency, and you know, all this movement to take money away from public schools for other initiatives, it certainly is going to erode the money that's there for everybody. So if we don't have a way, and we don't have a way as a school board to pass a bond for additional tax, it's totally up to the state.
Okay.
So unless the state gives school districts, especially urban districts, some additional funds, you know, things are not changing. Things are, gas is higher, food is higher. Cost of living is going up, but the wages and the money we have to run the district are not.
Okay.
So, yes, I think that even though this contract is a good contract, we can live with it. I'm not necessarily happy that we're in this position because it's just taking away money from the classroom, money from the districts to provide, you know, what people would call quality education. They're still going to be educated, and we're doing everything, and this contract assures that we can do it. At this point in time.
All right.
How many more cuts can we absorb? We may be cutting the district out of existence.
Okay.
You know?
We have to stay on top of this. The Lansing School District, a new five-year contract agreement with the LSEA. Guillermo Lopez is the president of the Lansing Board of Education. Thanks, Guillermo. Good luck.
Thank you.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. In January, the city of Lansing announced that the city had been awarded a $1.5 million Bloomberg Philanthropies grant to establish a financial empowerment center. Only four other cities, all of them bigger, Denver, Nashville, Philadelphia, and San Antonio, got the grants. Lansing Center opened yesterday. It is modeled after one in New York City. It'll offer free one-on-one financial counseling to low-income residents over the next 3 years. It's located at Tabernacle of David Church on West Holmes Road. And this morning we're joined by Amber Paxton, Director of Lansing's Office of Financial Empowerment. Good morning, Amber.
Good morning.
And Velma Kaiser of Capital Area Community Services, who's the center's program manager. Good morning, Velma.
Good morning.
And we're going to learn more about Lansing's new Financial Empowerment Center. This sounds like all upside. Is it to you?
It's all upside.
Yeah, this just sounds like a great, great deal. How was it Lansing was chosen, anyway? Those other cities that were chosen were all significantly bigger, and they could have chosen from so many other middle-sized cities across the country. How did that happen?
Absolutely. We're actually the only city in the Midwest that got it.
Okay.
And definitely the smallest. And I'll tell you that what truly made that happen was that our local government and our nonprofits and our community were already doing so much for financial empowerment. So we had already laid that foundation there's a local nonprofit here in Lansing called the Asset Independence Coalition, and that's co-chaired by City Treasurer Antonia Krause and County Treasurer Eric Schertzing. So we've always had the city and the county at the table when it comes to financial empowerment, and that's why we were chosen.
How about that? What will this money pay for exactly? This is one-on-one financial counseling, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
And
tell us more.
And I wanted to say we are located at Tabernacle of David Church, but our hub site, our main headquarters site, is at Capital Area Community Services, and then Tabernacle of David is a satellite site, as well as Advent House Ministries, Head Start on Grand River, and DHS.
Velma, who are the counselors?
The counselors are Kenyatta Davidson, who is at DHS, and also she serves the Tabernacle of David location.
Okay.
And we have Jim Crane, who is at the Capital Area Community Services location. We have Sonia Diallo, and we have Rebecca Urban.
Very good. Those four. How have they been trained? What qualifies them to be counselors? Is it all kinds of different backgrounds or what?
Yes. I take pride in knowing that I have a wonderful team there. We've gone through a real boot camp training that went through the partnership with Lansing Community College. And it showed us everything we need to know as far as doing one-on-one counseling with our customers. However, they come to the table with experience in that field. Rebecca and Jim also worked for Capital Area Community Services, where they had done one-on-one counseling with different clients, from homeless prevention to expansion program and foreclosure prevention. Sonia came from City of Lansing, where she was the homeless management information systems administrator.
Okay.
As well as Rebecca Urban, who was there when she did that as well. And Kenyatta Davidson also comes to us from a financial institution where she has 15 years of financial services there.
Okay. What kind of nuts and bolts problems, Amber, do you think these counselors will be able to help people with?
Sure. We actually have four service plans that are part of this. And so we're following the Bloomberg model exactly. And the Bloomberg model says that we offer four service plans in credit, debt, savings, and banking. And so those counselors will meet with the client one-on-one, and they'll do a financial health assessment where they'll look at their whole financial life, and then they'll look at what are their future hopes and dreams and plans and goals, and then look at what service plans, and it can be more than one simultaneously, should they be in. So for instance, if it's banking, do they have a bank account? Have they ever been denied a bank account? Are they in a safe and affordable one that's accessible to them? Because if you have a bank account but it's across town and you don't drive, then that's not an accessible bank account for you. So we have specific measurable outcomes for each of those service plans.
And how do people access this cool new program?
All they need to do is call 211. Or the alternate number for 211, which is 866-561-2500. and they can make appointments during the day, during the evening, on Saturdays. We make it very convenient.
How many people do you have any idea how many people in the Lansing area you expect to serve?
We expect to serve 4,000 people.
Okay, that's kind of part of your framework now?
Yes.
4,000 people?
Yes.
Okay. And how did day one go?
Great.
Okay. Did you have people coming for help?
Yes.
On day
yes.
one? Okay.
Yes. We basically started last week campaigning for people to come into the program. And as of yesterday, we have had
38
sessions.
Okay. Any patterns emerge from those 38 that you can talk to us about? Is it, you said credit, debt, banking, what else, Amber?
Savings.
And savings. Mm-hmm. Are there patterns that are emerging from amongst those 38? Is it debt? Is it credit? Is it just a mixed bag?
It is a truly mixed bag. It's all across the spectrum of those four areas. Several people are interested in their credit. People are interested in savings. And as well as getting an affordable bank account. So we have no specific, say, this is all they're looking for. There, it's all across the board.
How is foreclosure a common theme so far? Too early to say.
That has not been a session yet. However, I do have a foreclosure specialist there to support them.
Okay.
We are seeing mm-hmm. folks who are either immediately facing eviction or frightened that they're going to be
okay,
facing eviction.
The
we're seeing that as a very big theme.
Wow. Five years after the financial crisis. Mm-hmm, holy mm-hmm. cow. How are you getting the word out about this?
We are doing media like crazy.
Okay.
And we are also, we have a phenomenal group of partners. Our main nonprofit partner is Capital Area Community Services. But we are getting referrals from, we brought these folks in at the very beginning planning stages back when we were still writing the proposal for this grant. So we have agencies like Michigan Department of Corrections, Cristo Rey Community Center, Department of Human Services, the city's other social service groups, you
okay.
know, you know, other city departments. It's truly such a community-wide effort. That we are having no problem filling our slots.
We are talking about Lansing's brand new Financial Empowerment Center. It launched yesterday, and we want to thank Amber Paxton, director of the Lansing office, along with Velma Kaiser of Capital Area Community Services, who is the center's program manager. Many thanks and good luck.
Thank you.
Sometimes you're happy and sometimes you're sad. But the world goes round. Sometimes you lose every nickel you've had.
Chicago, Cabaret, New York, New York. The music of John Kander and Fred Ebb is featured in the Musical Review and The World Goes Round tomorrow night at East Lansing High School. The performance by East Lansing students is followed by the Gala of Gratitude fundraising event at the East Lansing Marriott. The fundraising gala is part of the East Lansing Education Foundation's effort to raise $1 million for East Lansing students in support of the rich tradition of theater in East Lansing schools. The foundation's closing in on this amazing goal, having already raised more than $700,000. Many East Lansing High School theater, music, and arts graduates have gone on to professional performing and administrative arts careers across the U.S. and here locally. Some will be returning for this event. One of those people is Dana Brazil. Brazil is the associate director of the MSU Federal Credit Union's Institute for Arts and Creativity at the Wharton Center. She's a professional actress, teacher, and MFA acting student at Michigan State University. WKAR's Peter Worf spoke with Dana Brazil yesterday, who remembered her days at East Lansing High.
I wanted to get involved, and, you know, everyone told me, you know, about Kate Bile and what a great theater program, and, you know, if I was a freshman, I could expect to be in the chorus, and I really, really, really wanted a part in that play, and the play was Grease my freshman year, and I auditioned, and I was lucky enough to be given a role in that show as a freshman. So I played Cha-Cha Di Gregorio, the best dancer at St. Bernadette's in Greece.
Nice.
And I remember specifically every moment, about every hour I spent with Kate Bile and in that theater. Both her and Theta Asif shaped the path of my life. and projected kind of opened in me an awareness of this arts and my love for the arts. That's why I'm still in the game, and I attribute all of that back to those two ladies.
You're now the Associate Director of Michigan State University Federal Credit Union's Institute for Arts and Creativity at the Wharton Center.
Correct.
And you're an MFA acting student at Michigan State University, a professional actor and teaching artist. And I read in your bio that in your spare time, you also like teaching at the Williamston Theater. Let me ask you about teaching at the Williamston Theater. What's that experience like for you?
That has been an amazing opportunity for me to continue to reach out to students. I love theater, and I love to teach theater because I love to pass on my love of theater to young people. Whether they choose to be actors or they're just exploring it, I love to watch them go through the process and see the light bulbs go off when they make a discovery for themselves. And I have been teaching there for the last 6 years and loving every minute of it, and loving that we have a professional equity theater in our community or just outside of our community. And it's been a great resource, too, for the Michigan State University Department of Theater. There's been a lot of collaborations and partnerships, so I'm just happy that I could be part of it.
East Lansing High School performing alums will be returning to the stage, as we said earlier, for the performance on Saturday. What's your part?
I will be doing a song by Cantor and Ebb called "The Grass Is Always Greener."
I'll bet your friends are all celebrities. That's wonderful.
What's so wonderful? You can make a pot roast. That's wonderful.
What's so wonderful? First you brown an onion. The public wants your autograph. That's wonderful.
What's so wonderful? You raised a teenage daughter. That's wonderful.
What's so wonderful? First you find her diaphragm.
Oh, the grass is always greener.
It's a duet from the show Woman of the Year, and I will be performing that with Kristen Hubbard, and I'm very excited to be doing that.
What's it like for you to be able to come kind of full circle then as an outreach director at one of Mid-Michigan's most prominent performance organizations, as a professional performer and teacher? What's it like to be able to come back and help to assist in the future of students in the arts?
I love to give back to the arts, especially to East Lansing High School, because so many opportunities were created for me at that high school. So I like to be able to go back and see where they're at, and also in my role at the Wharton Center, be able to provide those students with opportunities as well. So it's like coming home, like going full circle.
Dana Brazil is the Associate Director of Michigan State University Federal Credit Union's Institute for Arts and Creativity at the Wharton Center, and an MFA acting student at Michigan State University, as well as a professional actor and teacher. Dana, thanks for doing this, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
Coming up on the program, the Free Press's Joe Rexroad on Michigan State and Memphis, and Dr. Donald Heller is the dean of MSU's College of Education. He says the Michigan 2020 plan that would offer some college tuition for all Michigan high school graduates is flawed. Don Heller joins us in just a few minutes on Current State. It's Current State for Friday. Many thanks for all the emails we've been getting, too. Here, we've got a lot of great ideas for program segments and all kinds of feedback. We do appreciate it. currentstate@wkar.org. A few weeks ago, Democrats in the Michigan Senate, led by East Lansing's Gretchen Whitmer, announced that the Michigan 2020 plan is their highest legislative priority in 2013. The measure would offer some amount of free college tuition for all high school graduates in the state. It would be funded by eliminating almost $2 billion in loopholes in the Michigan tax code. One influential educator here at Michigan State University has come out against the idea. Dr. Donald Heller is the dean of MSU's College of Education, and he writes in a Detroit Free Press op-ed that the proposal is, quote, seriously flawed and should not be enacted, unquote. We're happy to welcome Dr. Donald Heller to Current State to talk about this. How are you?
Good. Thank you very much for having me, Mark.
Could you briefly revisit the basics, then, of the Michigan 2020 plan as you understand it?
Sure. The basics of the plan, Mark, are that the Senate Democrats have proposed that every student graduating from Michigan High School would be given free tuition for 4 years of college at a cost of roughly $1.8 billion. So that's what the idea is. Everybody would get free tuition as long as they graduated from Michigan High School and attended a public university in the state.
Clarify for me, though, if they did not spend all 4 years in the Michigan High School, would they still get 4 years of college tuition?
Well, I think that's one of the details that would have to be worked out. The plan is fairly broad, as I understand it at this point. So I think as the legislation would be moved through, they'd have to work out some of those details. But the idea is to get the message across that everybody could go to college for free.
If they graduate from high school in Michigan.
Correct.
And there are a few problems with Michigan 2020 as you see it. What's at the top of your list?
Well, the main reason is, and let me say, first of all, I agree with the goal of trying to get more students into college and through to getting degrees at the end of the process. The main problem with the Senate Democrats' plan is that it's going to be subsidizing the college tuition of thousands and thousands of students who can well afford and their families can afford to pay that tuition. And if the Democrats can find $1.8 billion, I have lots of many better ideas of how they could spend that just related to education alone.
Okay. Where should that money go?
Well, one of the points I made in my op-ed in the Free Press is that it's not enough to simply give students money to be able to go to college. Students have to be prepared, academically prepared, to do college-level work. And lots of the students in the state who come from low-income, even middle-income families, don't have that level of preparation. So I rather see a lot of that money going and targeted as financial aid or free tuition for students from lower, middle-income families, as well as giving them more help and giving their schools more help to prepare them to be successful once they're in college.
So of $1.8 billion or so, you would suggest half go to low and middle income families that don't have the financial wherewithal to send a kid to college and half to improving K through 12.
Well, we could have a discussion of exactly how you would split the money. But the important thing is you don't want to be spending state tax dollars to subsidize families who can well afford to pay that college tuition.
Okay.
That's the idea. And we could discuss where the cutoff could be, but let's start with half and work from there.
I'm curious if you've had any contact with Senator Whitmer about this.
Well, I haven't heard from her. We did give her a copy of the op-ed before it ran in the newspaper, so she had some advance notice, but I haven't heard from her directly.
What's been the response to your op-ed? Have you gotten much?
I've heard some responses. I've had some people who disagree with it, but a number of people, I think, agree with the perspective that in an era when tax dollars are very scarce, it simply doesn't make sense to subsidize higher-income people who can afford to pay for college. You know, the data are very clear, Mark. People from upper-income families are going to college, they're persisting through and getting degrees, and they simply don't need that subsidy from scarce state tax dollars.
How do you feel about early education? There is so much discussion about the early education thing. Should arguably some percentage of this money also go there?
Sure, absolutely. The governor had made early education a priority in his State of the State speech. Yesterday when my op-ed ran, right below it was an op-ed from a VP from the Kellogg Foundation who argued that the state needs to invest more in early childhood education, and I couldn't agree with that any more.
There is also legislation making its way through the Capitol that would expand the authority of the state's Education Achievement Authority, the EAA. This is the recently launched body overseeing, I believe it's 15 failing Detroit schools. Supporters of expanding the EAA, mostly Republicans, say it's doing great work and it ought to include the lowest ranked 5% of the state's school. That ought to become a percentage, which would, I believe, bump that 15 number up
I want to say in the 30s or thereabouts. What do you think of this proposal to expand the EAA?
Well, I'm a little bit concerned because I think we need to see more evidence about exactly how well the EAA schools are performing in Detroit. And, you know, we're now about two-thirds of the way through their first school year. They got started very late last spring, and I think it's simply too early to tell whether they're successful or not before we decide to go ahead and give them more schools.
Most Democrats allege the program is too new, as you say, and we simply can't know for sure if it's working. They have a point then, in your view.
I agree with that perspective. I'd like to see some evidence that they are successful before we give them more authority.
How long should a program like EAA run before it's assessed with an eye to possible expansion?
Well, that's a good question, but, you know, at a minimum, I'd like to see a couple years' worth of data. You know, to be fair to the EAA, you've got to discount that first year, given how late they got started in that first year. So I would like to see a couple years' worth of data to see how well those schools and their students are performing before we go ahead and say, let's give you responsibility for more schools across the state.
Part of the rationale, I guess, of expansion seems to be that some number of schools are so clearly failing that they seem to be less interested in waiting for a more comprehensive assessment. Is it that desperate? That obviously, to some people's thinking, it is. It's that desperate that if something shows even preliminary signs of an improvement, then you go for it.
Well, I think you're right, Mark, that a lot of people have that perspective, that any other alternative is better than the current situation. But I don't even think we have the preliminary results yet to determine whether the EAA is being successful as opposed to other alternatives.
Do I have the numbers right on that, by the way? I think it's 15 in Detroit.
It's 14 or 15,
14
I believe,
or
this
15,
year. Yeah.
And they want to expand it to the bottom 5%, which would, I want to say, at least double.
Oh, it would be more than that. I mean, I don't know how many schools there are total in the state, but it would be well more than doubling the current 14 or 15.
Now, a couple of days ago, the Michigan House Higher Education Appropriations Subcommittee advanced a bill that would take away 15% of state funding from universities that pass new long-term union contracts if those new contracts don't cut costs by at least 10%. Have you been following this?
I've heard the stories in the media, yes.
Okay. What do you make of that proposal?
Well, I think it's a very difficult situation to put the universities in. I think the two universities who were affected, Wayne State and the University of Michigan, I think were bargaining in good faith with their unions. They were trying to do what they believe is the right thing. And for the legislature to withhold some of their state appropriations simply for negotiating and agreeing on new contracts, I don't believe is fair to those institutions. And in the end, cutting money from the two universities is going to hurt the students attending those universities.
Now, one of the proponents of this measure, Representative Al Pasholka, maintains that the new long-term contracts really didn't amount to savings. Have you looked at it closely enough to know whether that there's any validity to that?
No, I can't answer that. I haven't looked at the contracts to answer that question.
Okay. What do you make of this pattern of the longer-term contracts being approved by local districts and universities as well?
Well, I don't believe that the universities or school districts, for that matter, are necessarily trying to get around the right-to-work laws. You know, universities and school districts in the state are under extreme amount of financial pressure, as you know. And they're simply trying to figure out the best way to ensure that they can deliver the services to their students, whether they're in K-12 schools or universities. And they're negotiating with their – I have to believe they're negotiating with their unions in good faith, and they're trying to do what's best, not simply get around the right-to-work laws.
Can we talk about the core curriculum proposal?
Sure.
As well? There is another movement afoot at the state capitol that would undo stricter educational standards that were passed about 5 or 6 years ago, if memory serves here. I want to say it would eliminate the hardcore requirement of Algebra 2 and foreign language requirements. There's a number of Republicans and even a few Democrats who say a student pursuing a vocational path, a non-college path, it shouldn't be held to that high a standard. What do you make of that discussion?
Well, I think the bill you're talking about was a piece of legislation introduced by Representative McMillan, and there was a hearing in front of the House Education Committee on Wednesday to discuss that bill. And basically what it would do would be to prohibit the State Board of Education from implementing the Common Core state standards. Now, these are the standards that have been agreed to by 47 states, including Michigan and the District of Columbia, and Representative McMillan's legislation would pull Michigan out of that. I think it would would be a big mistake. At that hearing, Bill Schmidt, one of our distinguished professors in the College of Education, testified at how it would harm the state if we did pull away from the Common Core state standards, and I agree 100%. I think it would weaken standards. I think in the end it would harm education for the state, and I don't think it's the right thing for the state to do.
Well, I mean, theoretically, how do you respond to a family who's got a young person who wants to study or is thoroughly planning on installing solar panels or going to work in HVAC repair or something like that? How do you justify that foreign language requirement, though?
Well, you know, Governor Snyder, in addition to making early childhood education a priority, has also argued we need more vocational and technical forms of training for students here in the state. And I agree with him 100% that we need to have better paths for students who don't necessarily want to go to universities and get a university degree. So we have to have some flexibility in the curriculum. But the Common Core state standards allow school districts to have some flexibility. They're not locked into such a rigid set of standards that they're not going to be able to develop, for example, more vocational tracks that would help those students who do want to go into some kind of trade when they graduate from high school. And I think this is a misconception about the Common Core state standards, that it eliminates local control when, in fact, local districts will still have a large degree of flexibility.
Real quickly, how do you like being at the top at the College of Education at MSU?
I like it a lot. It's a challenging job. I've learned a lot in the year that I've been on the job, and I have the opportunity to work with great people, and that's a great place to work.
Dr. Don Heller is the Dean of the College of Education. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
Round one of the NCAA men's basketball tournament is history for 2013. Michigan State and U of M both logging victories yesterday in the Free Press's. Joe Rexroad is here to look ahead and look back a little bit. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Real good. Before we look ahead to Memphis, let's analyze yesterday's win over Valparaiso. The Spartans dominated. What was your takeaway?
Yeah, they really did. The final score, very deceiving. You know, the 27-point game in the second half, probably the best game Derek Nix has ever had, although at times it looked like he was a big kid playing with little kids out there. Probably get tougher for him moving forward. But he played very well. Keith Appling played very well. One concern is, you know, Keith Appling had a little tendonitis in his left knee, and he was limping around a little bit. So that's something to watch, especially because he has a very tough defensive assignment on Saturday.
Is the caliber of performance that we saw yesterday from Michigan State mandatory for MSU to win against Memphis on Saturday?
Yeah, I would say so. The caliber of performance in the middle, you know, 20 minutes or so. That really, some of the best basketball Michigan State has played this year. And I mean, you know, I guess I hesitate a little bit on that just because of the level of competition, but I really do believe that was just very crisp on offense and very good communication on defense. It's going to, I mean, Memphis is every bit Michigan State's athletic equal. I mean, across the board, athletes, talent, you know, powerful, and, you know, so it's a totally different kind of challenge here. And Michigan State really has to play mistake-free.
How does the Memphis style of play into or challenge the Spartans here on Saturday?
Well, you know, Memphis likes to play fast, and really I think Michigan State does too. I think the big thing that will be a challenge is Joe Jackson, their point guard, is very quick. And this year, Michigan State has really struggled in certain matchups when Keith Appling has had trouble keeping the other point guard in front of him. Miami, Shane Larkin, Indiana twice with Yogi Ferrell. He actually did a really good job against Trey Burke twice, but you know, this is another guy who's really, really quick, can get into the lane. And so I think that's the big key, is that once that happens and your defense has to help and break down, now you're helping off shooters and they're getting wide open shots in the corners. So that's where it all starts, and if he can keep him out of lane, that's a big key. And then, I mean, inside there are just going to be some brawls in this game. Not literally, I hope. You know, you look at Memphis's big men, Adonis Jordan against Adrian Payne, then Tariq Black against Derek Nix. I mean, we're talking about some big, strong guys going at it, and that's really just going to be who wins some of those battles.
Did you get any read from Tom Izzo regarding the Memphis matchup? What did he have to say about it?
Well, unfortunately, you know, Michigan State played first yesterday, and so they were already out of the building at halftime of that game. So very little, you know, a couple of the players talked, you know, there were some questions asked about Memphis guessing they'd win, and, you know, yeah, they're very athletic, but yeah, not much. So that's today. We'll be over there in a little bit and talk to both teams and get all that.
The Free Press's Joe Rexroad on Memphis and what lay ahead for the Michigan State Spartans. Thanks, Joe. Great to talk to you.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mark. Appreciate it.
Architect Albert Kahn was famous for his buildings around the state of Michigan throughout Detroit and Ann Arbor, and for factories and industrial facilities throughout the United States. Lansing is home to one Kahn building, the former Motor Wheel Factory. If you're focused on your driving there at the intersection of Saginaw and Larch, you might even miss the impressive former factory on the northeast corner. The Motor Wheel Factory has been converted into modern loft-styled condominiums. WKAR's Peter Wharf recently met with Lansing-based architecture writer and blogger John T. Madden to talk about Motor Wheel and Albert Kahn.
He was quite well known in his time, and as you can see, it's very much form follows function. He was influenced by Lewis Sullivan, who gave us that famous dictum for architecture. And it still looks very rectilinear and industrial today, but obviously it's been converted for more up-to-date purposes.
Yeah, John, will you talk to our listeners about what this building was originally intended to be used for?
Well, it was originally a manufactory for wheels and rims, both wooden and steel. It supplied both military and civilian contracting. It was originally the William K. Pruden Company. They still have the name Pruden on the smokestack. And it sort of grew up here in Lansing with Oldsmobile, which was another Lansing-based institution, later a core component of General Motors, of course, but discontinued at this time. Motor Wheel came around and provided originally again, wire, wheels, and rims, and things like that. It was first used in industry, and then when World War One came along, they needed it for artillery pieces, and so it was converted for a time for wartime construction, but then reconverted after that war to peacetime uses again. And it was a major local employer, and it helped to raise the standard of living here, as did Oldsmobile. Many people flocked here to work in this plant. But gradually, it later became Motor Wheel, from Pruden Company to Motor Wheel. And then it eventually, I think, became part of Goodyear, tire and rubber, and a unit of Goodyear. But then they decided to close this plant one building here. So it stayed in a state of somewhat disrepair for some time. Of course, it might have met the wrecker's ball, and which sometimes happens with these older industrial buildings. Fortunately, though, they came together. I think it was H Incorporated some time ago that decided to build to rebuild the interior and to preserve the exterior, including the Pruden stack, as well as the more up-to-date features you see here extending back to May Street, to make it a multi-use but mostly residential purpose. So they have like living room units with kitchens, and a variety of styles and options are available for prospective buyers. I think they also have rentals inside.
This is a building that's been converted into lofts. Can we talk a little bit, looking at the outside of this building, about what it might have been like inside back when it was a factory? We see a four-story building, a very large building. It's almost the size of what would be, you know, sort of half a city block. And one of the most notable features is the abundance of windows, almost floor to ceiling, to light the inside of these large factory spaces with natural light. Is that right?
Yeah, well, they wanted to have lighting come in. Today is a kind of energy saver of its time. And also they needed space, you know, to make the wheels and everything. So when they decided to remodel it, they more or less kept the spaciousness. And that's why you get a lot of square feet inside the units here in those lofts. They've maintained the exterior pretty much as it was, but completely refurbished interiors, and you can have your choice of different models, but they're very spacious, and they offer nice views of the area here.
Yeah, if you like a modern converted loft look, it's really quite striking and beautiful with the very high ceilings, the large spaces, and those concrete floors that people are growingly interested in.
Yes, people like that kind of utilitarian look, and it's almost like a recycled industrialism, you might say, and for a living unit. It's a kind of a novel approach.
Can you tell us any more about sort of the larger effort in Lansing to preserve historic buildings like this construction?
Oh, sure. Like over on the riverbank, there's the Accident Fund project. That was a building on Capitol Avenue that opened in 1987, and in the 90s, under the John Engler administration, they spun off the Accident Fund. It's now a private corporation. It was an agency of state government. And then they decided, after some debate on what to do with it, the old Ottawa Street Steam Station, which used to pump steam to the, you know, various buildings downtown, that was closed in the early 90s after about 50 years of service. And then they decided to build an extension, an up-to-date structure in brick and glass that would complement the older structure. They had to take down the smokestack and demolish a parking ramp out over Grand Avenue. And then they added a parking ramp back to the Shiawassee Street Bridge, except here it's just one function, an insurance company out of a former power station, but very innovative. And the LEDC has been largely responsible by the Lansing Economic Development Corporation. And they have other projects going around the area with disused schools and all throughout the Lansing area, former sites. Some of them are educational, some industrial. I like Motor Wheel and Accident Fund because they're two of the more prominent ones where they preserve the original architecture but make striking new, sensitive and inspired solutions to new uses.
Tell me how you came to be interested in buildings being reused.
Well, I've always liked industrial structures, and of course, had it been much earlier, I would have been here when in the heyday of Pruden or Motor Wheel. But I didn't arrive in this area until 1990. But I like any kind of project that takes disused structures, but, you know, saves them and then converts them to newer, more up-to-date purposes.
John T. Madden writes and blogs about historic Lansing area buildings and repurposing of historic buildings. John, thanks so much for taking the time on this cold mid-March afternoon.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. I'm glad to be here.
For Current State, this is Peter Borf.
And just in case you haven't memorized the details for the next Michigan State and Michigan NCAA men's tournament games, I'm sure there's one or two of you. Oh, okay, there's one. Michigan State in Memphis, Saturday, 2:45 tip. For Michigan, it's tomorrow at 12:15 p.m., U of M and Virginia Commonwealth. And we can't forget the Michigan State women either. It's Marist at College Park, Maryland. That tip-off is 1:30 p.m. here tomorrow as well, and that'll be televised on ESPN. Coming up next week on Current State, we'll tell you all about the 100-year study where researchers are exploring how the health of the Great Lakes has changed over the past century. We'll also look at the book The Summer of 68, which looks at the tragic and turbulent year through the lens of baseball. That and more next week here on Current State. The executive producer of our program is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Emmanuel Berry, Aaron Young for engineering, and Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance as well. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State.
Support for WKAR is provided by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan. FlukeHearing.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. Alumni.msu.edu.